Good morning, everybody. Good morning on day four of SHA 2017. Our next speaker is Dr. Melanie Reebok. She is the CEO and co-founder of Radically Open Security, the world's first non-profit computer security consulting company. And not only was she named ICT Professional of the Year in 2010, and one of the most successful women in the Netherlands, but also in 2016, she was one of the most inspiring women in tech. So we'll give her a warm welcome.
Hello. Can you guys hear me okay? Perfect. So, all right. I'm here with more stories. I last night gave a talk that was a bit more of a personal nature. Today I'm giving a talk I think that's a bit more of a technical nature. So the story that I'm going to tell today is basically a job that we had performed for one of our customers. I do have permission to say who the customer is. In this particular case, we were working with SurfNet. I had actually invited them to come and join us for this talk. They unfortunately were not able to actually, you know, physically be here. But in either case, I do have a special guest who is going to join very briefly at the end. But I'm going to tell a story about spear phishing, about the technical side of it, about the tooling side of it, and a little bit surprisingly towards the end, a bit about the ethical and the philosophical side of it. From the perspective of a security consultancy company. So we will start at the beginning. We were asked to conduct their annual spear phishing test for 2016. And what the situation was, they wanted us to so-called spear phish the entire organization. Yeah, spear phish 150 people. Okay, that's not really spear phishing, but, you know, nonetheless. And the definition of the job that they wanted was they wanted a low and slow phishing attack. You know, low and slow, 150 people, you know, again. But these are lessons, you know. Of course, us being incredibly bright-eyed and eager, we're like, yes, of course we can do that, you know. And, well, so the way that, we started was by registering a domain. We wanted to come up with something fairly innocuous sounding. So we registered the domain clickanalytics.amsterdam. Actually, the first use for the .amsterdam domain I've ever had, but I love those new TLDs. But why Click Analytics? Because everybody is used to click trackers. You know, and if you basically use something that sounds like a bit, you know, analytics-y, then, you know, people might not think that it's malicious. So that was our reasoning behind registering that particular domain. Malware was out of scope. I mean, they basically said, look, if we click, we believe that you can own us, you know, but given that we want to, you know, really just check our entire staff and we want to keep the budget within certain constraints, we only want to look at click tracking and click percentages. So that, again, these are just the rules of the game now, you know, of the engagement. And another thing that we basically then did is we set up a landing page that essentially just said insert malicious code here as a placeholder. Because of course, you could very well just as easily insert your client side exploit here. But again, that was outside of the rules of engagement for this particular assignment. They just wanted to know, are people going to click or not? So, low and slow. So we figured, okay, how do you do a low and slow phishing attack? Well, why don't we just start with one test subject? So we took our point of contact, and we knew that he was incredibly into running. So we basically said, okay, well, you know, low and slow, spear phishing, targeted. Why don't we try and take a running newsletter? Because we know he's super into running. So he's going to click on that, right? So, indeed, you know, we subscribe to some newsletters, you know, Keep On Running, Pindanel, you know, we, you know, just to see if we could use it. So we took the running newsletter. We basically manually, scraped the thing, converted the URLs so that if you clicked on the URLs, it would land on our Click Analytics tracking page. And, you know, it basically took us a day to put together a fairly good-looking pretext, you know, that was actually targeted to this particular guy. So, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, we sent off the email. And we waited. And we waited. He didn't click. And then we kind of figured out, this might be harder than we thought. Especially if they want us to fish 150 people. So, all right. Yeah, what's plan B? So, if we think that we're going to have any hope at all of being able to actually target a larger group of people, it's becoming evident to us that automation might be needed here. But of course, then we start to, redefining the engagement somewhat, because at that point, it becomes a little bit less spearfishing and a little bit more generic phishing. I mean, we're still trying to target it, but, you know, again, trying to target this mass group of people, you know. And, So we came up with a new idea. And our idea was, well, what about spam? You know, everybody receives it. Sometimes people click on it, depending on what the spam is. And nobody's going to think it's suspicious. You know, because by definition, spam is unwanted and spam is annoying. And if people are annoyed by it, then they're not going to be suspicious, right? we figured, we could try, this is an experiment. So, another thing, though, also about spam is we receive a whole bunch of it. So basically what we can do is we can just like take the spam that we receive, and then we can just write scripts to automatically instrument it, so that when you click on it, it goes to our landing page, with the insert malware here, placeholder. And voila, at that point, if we just collect enough sort of relevant pieces of spam, then we can probably get a good part of the organization. Yeah. So that was sort of our thinking. So that leads then to the question of how much do you actually want to target it? Spear phishing by definition is fairly highly targeted. But the question is, what are the pros and cons of targeting? The thing about spam is actually not always highly targeted. Sometimes spam is actually pretty generic. But people click on it anyways. And the thing is that if you do target somebody, if they notice that something's wrong, they're going to get suspicious much faster. Whereas if you target somebody less, and instead you just send something a bit more spammy, if they notice there's something wrong with it, well, I mean, there's, spelling mistakes and half the spam emails that we get anyways, or if something's not entirely correct. So the truth of the matter is that targeting is not actually always better. but again, these were some of the things, that we were experimenting with and learning during this job. So the question then became really, to what extent should we be targeting individual staff members versus just trying to come up with more blanket generic pretexts, so we can sort of stay under the radar and just sort of hope that people are going to be kind of stupid and click anyways. So these are some of the questions that we wanted to ask. So we took a pretext. I apologize, the image quality isn't great, but we took basically one of those book bundles. I have to say, we love book bundles. In fact, I think I just recently purchased this hacking book bundle, Anyway, but a lot of us like this kind of stuff. So we took one of these, so this story bundle, and we basically took it, scraped it, instrumented it, and then sent it off to a group of people. What wound up happening was people clicked. it was fairly generic, it was kind of spammy, it wasn't really that targeted, but people liked it. Another thing that we did, and this is kind of evil, but I decided to do it anyways, is, you know, we were dealing again with SurfNet, and they're very much in the internet community. So at one point, I decided we were going to take the invitation letter for the ISOC.NL New Year's Borel. So, and then basically take that, instrument it, send it. I told Michiel Lehnars that I was doing it, and he kind of rolled his eyes at me. But, you know, so we did. And surprisingly, actually fewer people clicked. And you would think, why, right? Because, you know, a lot of the people at Surf are actually going to this thing, you know. And this is actually something that's more relevant to the community. But actually more people clicked on the pretext related to the book bundle. Why? I don't know. Just, you know, just because something actually is somewhat highly targeted to the area that people are working in actually doesn't always mean they're going to click more often. Which, again, I think to me at least started to challenge some of my assumptions about phishing and targeting, you know. So this was interesting. So what wound up happening is, and right now I'm basically going to, I decided to use screenshots today because I don't feel like opening my email on a live stream, but, you know, only hackers are watching what could happen. But, sorry, the image quality is so horrible. Sorry about that. Anyway, this is a screenshot from Rocket Chat, which basically is our working environment within Radically Open Security. And what we did, and I'm sorry this is barely readable, but basically the first thing that I did here is I executed a command using our chatbot that basically said rawspot shell command create pretext SHA-2017 volunteers. And what I did is I actually put in the URL https SHA-2017.org/, I think it was, here, let me actually read it from my screen, sorry. Call for volunteers. And then after that, I put the sender email address, which basically is noreply@SHA2017.org. So essentially what I did this morning is I basically just scraped the most latest blog article from the SHA website. And I basically said, I want to take this website, I want to scrape it, and then I want to turn it into a phishing mail with this pretext name, so that SHA-2017 volunteers, I'm sorry, this isn't very readable, but the SHA-2017 volunteers is the name of the pretext. And then what we do is we decouple the actual stored pretext, so the creation of the pretext, from actually sending it. So we can actually create a database of targets using a list of group names, and then we can then send different sort of pretexts to different groups at different times. So that's the way that we set up this spear phishing toolkit. So, sorry, this isn't readable. So basically, what wound up happening then is, if you could read this, it basically says Rawspot getting pretext. So the first thing that it's actually basically picking up the page. So you can see sort of here this call for volunteers right around here. So it's actually right now downloading the web page. At that point, then what it is doing is I call another command. So you can see this command right here, this rawspot shell command spearfish send. So at this point, we can either send to groups or send to individuals. I wanted to send to myself. So I said spearfish send, SHA-2017 volunteers, Melanie@radicallyopensecurity.com. So in this case, I only wanted to send it to myself, so I did. So the next thing that happens, and again, sorry, this is not very readable on the big screen, but it then says Melanie@radicallyopensecurity.com has hash number and then the hash ID with email Melanie@radicallyopensecurity.com. And then the next thing that you see is it says, I received a click in a phishing email by Melanie@radicallyopensecurity.com. I received an image view in a phishing mail using the pretext SHA-2017 volunteers. And then you can see right here at the bottom, it actually registered a second click. So I received a click in a phishing mail by Melanie@radicallyopensecurity.com. So the way that it actually works and how I did it with SurfNet and also how I've done it with other customers is we actually let, again, the customers into the chat room. And the fun part is they can actually watch while the people in their own organization are clicking. And they can actually see it coming in real time, which is really a lot of fun. You know, and they can actually see who did the clicking, because in the URL, I mean, essentially all we're doing in the URL is just hashing essentially the pretext name, the sender email address, you know, and then based on this hash ID, that, you know, it's stored in our database. So we can then, of course, look up which pretext was it, which email address was it, and then it renders that in real time, more or less, in the in the chat room. So that's essentially how the spear phishing suite works. So the actual email itself, this is a little bit easier to read, but what you can see now is this is the blog post that I was talking about from the SHA website. So that script that we wrote, basically all it did was scrape it, turn it into an email, and you can basically see that I was viewing this, I think, in Thunderbird. You know, and the sender email address should be what we specified, which is basically, and we always use no reply at, and then choose your domain name, because that way if people try to respond to it, they're not going to get anything. And yeah, and for the rest, all of the links, if you click on them, what's going to happen is first it's going to go to our landing page. So in this case, click analytics.amsterdam. Of course, in the future, I'm not going to be using that one anymore because I'm telling you guys what it is, but but you guys get the idea. So yeah, so first it goes to click analytics.amsterdam, and then the next thing that it does is it redirects to the actual content. So at that point, people actually are on the page where they expect to be. So another thing that was made things a little bit more complicated is this actually only works really for HTML mails, because if people are using text-based email clients, or if people are using certain mail clients where HTML is turned off, sometimes by default, then you actually can see the redirect through Click Analytics. You know, it's a design decision whether or not we want to be able to operate with non-HTML mails. In our case, what we did is we actually just put in a warning that if somebody opened it in a non-HTML compliant email reader, we basically just said, we're sorry, you know, this email cannot be displayed, you know, because there's HTML, use another email client. So we did that to basically prevent people, you know, with non-HTML browsers from being able to see our landing page. Just in case Click Analytics.amsterdam might make anybody suspicious. So, all right. So, you know, with this toolkit, it basically gave us a number of knobs that we could turn in this experiment. So it gave us, you know, the targeted versus non-targeted knob that we could adjust. Other things that we could adjust, for example, were batch sizes. You know, answering questions like, is it better to fish more people at once? You know, but then, you know, risk that they're going to talk with each other. But at the same time, of course, fishing more people at once is also more efficient. And remember, we're trying to do this within a budget, you know, which is limited. So, you know, we can't spend unlimited amounts of time on this either. But of course, that's exactly the same plight that a real attacker is going to have as well. You have to try and make trade-offs about how effectively you can actually fish somebody versus the amount of time and effort that you want to spend on it. So, all right. So, surprise, surprise. The number one most clicked pretext was a fake LinkedIn invitation. Again, we're talking about highly technical people. You know, and to me, it was actually really surprising that when we sent a whole bunch of really targeted pretexts, and then we sent a whole bunch of really generic pretexts, what did people click on? The generic stuff. Even though they were highly technical, highly IT savvy, actually reasonably security savvy people. And that, to me, was really a surprise. So, yeah. So that was certainly one of the lessons that we learned. I mean, you know, perhaps also some of you guys can, you know, it starts to make you reevaluate perhaps how in your own phishing awareness sessions maybe you're going to present some of this stuff. But yeah, I mean, but the truth is even highly technical people click on this kind of stuff too. So detailed breakdown. Total target addresses, 145. In the end, we did 14 mailings. the reason, again, this is why we needed the automation. If we had actually tried doing 14 independent pretexts by hand, it would have taken us forever. You know, so that's actually why, in the end, we sort of needed the scraping tools and being able to scrape it automatically from websites, because that allowed us to create those pretexts really quickly. So we sent 528 messages. 261 times these messages were opened, and we were actually able to see if they were opened by image views. So we also had instrumented the images in the HTML mails in the same way that spammers, you know, often do. So we could actually see, even if they didn't click on it, we were still able to see if they opened the mail to look at it. Total clicks, 46. Unique click IP addresses, 29. And the most clicked pretext was LinkedIn, with 8 clicks. So the funny thing was, the biggest problem that we wound up having was the spam filter. Surprise. Yeah, but if you're trying to fish with spam, that's what happens. So what we wound up doing is, we first started researching SPF values to basically try and figure out how we could evade the spam filter. So that was interesting. And also, we found that the optimum batch size of phishing spam, so basically using spam to fish, were batches large enough to hit as many targets as possible without getting marked by the spam filter. Seriously. So, yeah, again, this went in sort of completely surprising directions, you know, while we were doing this job. But it makes sense, I mean, when you think about it. So, you know, at first we were being really, really cautious. And then as the deadline towards the end of the phishing job came up, we started getting more and more aggressive, just because we wanted to know sort of how far can we push this before people start noticing. So we started, you know, getting a little bit ballsy. We started, you know, doing things that were a little bit more reckless, just because, well, look, if they catch us, that's one of the end conditions of this phishing test. At some point, actually, we kind of want them to catch us because we want to know how far we can push it, you know. So at a certain point, what we did is, we started increasing the batch sizes, you know, just to see would they notice. That didn't really attract too much attention. What did attract our attention the very first time, though, was sending basically a fake Mozilla security update to the CSERT team. You know, if we were really trying to be low and slow, we wouldn't have done that. But we basically just figured, yeah, let's see if they're paying attention. So we did that, and indeed, they noticed. So we wound up getting 6 clicks on the fake Mozilla security update. We are presuming from a sandboxed environment. And of course, the CSERT team. The other thing also is that we didn't really take much effort to try and hide our tracks. So if you did actually look at the Click Analytics domain, it was actually registered to Radically Open Security. You know, I mean, look, if I were a real attacker, like a malicious one, I would have gone to more effort to try and hide our identity. But the way that I figured it, you know, if they got suspicious, I actually wanted to lead back to us quickly so they can understand that it's a phishing test. And so we're not going to cause too much damage, hopefully, you know, while they're trying to figure out what actually happened. So, but then, you know, things at one point sort of got a little bit out of control. So I guess first I'm gonna tell my side of the story, and then I'm gonna invite a special guest up on stage to tell his side of the story. So there's this new media organization called Setup in Utrecht. And, you know, they've got a lot of good connections with the SURF organization, and there's a lot of people within SURF that are on the board or that are, you know, members of Setup or that like them. So we basically figured, well, let's take Setup and let's use them as a pretext, because, again, we were experimenting with targeting. We basically figured, you know, what harm is it going to do, right? I mean, it's basically just going to, you know, it's going to stay within the SURF environment, and, you know, Setup probably won't even notice, and, you know, everything's going to be great. That's what we thought, until it escaped. So I guess probably now is the time. I'm going to invite Timon on stage here to tell his side of the story.
Yes, well, that was fun. So we suddenly started with the tweet that we got, and we just started thinking, like, what is it said that, hey, Setup, stop spamming us. What's going on, you know, with your systems? And we were felt immediately quite ashamed. And I remember, like, I thought, I built the first version of our website, and it used to have this mailing module in it in Drupal. And I thought, oh, maybe that's been abused. So I started going to the website, disabling stuff, modules from way back when, and hoping that would fix it. And while my colleague Frank Jan, he's communications guy, and he was trying to, you know, communicate on Twitter and make, you know, everybody feel okay. And that we spent basically an afternoon trying to handle this and trying to understand what was going on. And we found out what really the cause was. And maybe I can go into a little bit about what happened after, because in the end it was really good for us. Because Surfnet got in touch with us, and we got in touch with them, and in the end they became our sponsor for our yearly privacy lecture that we do in the center. Yeah, so that was a really good outcome for us, where they said, you know, we'll try to compensate for you. And now they're doing it again this year, so it became a running thing, which is nice. So in the end it was really good for us, but that day was really like, what the hell's going on? Yeah, so that's a bit my story. Anything else, maybe for the questions?
Yeah, but that was kind of a stressful day for me too, because I was on my way back from a customer. I'd just gotten off the train. I was like just getting in the bus. So I got a phone call like, Melanie, log into Rocket Chat now. I was just like, oh crap, what's going on? So I basically log in. It's sort of like panic. They're like, oh my God, you know, we've been caught, and they're angry, and oh my God, like, legal action, and like, oh my God, I have to fix this. So I you know, I spent basically the first, you know, 24 hours like on the phone with everybody. Like, I was on the phone with setup, like profusely apologizing. I was on the phone with the Surf organization, because what wound up happening is people from Surf literally started posting on Twitter, you know, setup, why are you spamming us? I was like, crap. So now I have to basically talk to people, everybody in the Surf organization, you know, who didn't know about the phishing test, and tell them immediately what's going on, so they'll basically take stuff off of Twitter, you know. And at the same time, you know, we're supposed to be the ethical security company here. Yeah, oops, you know. You know, sometimes we make some mistakes too, you know. But yeah, so the first day was really just damage control. And, you know, once we got the damage control, I mean, as he said, I mean, in the end, you know, hopefully all's well that ends well, but we learned some lessons from it, you know. And those lessons are things that I think that everybody can learn from, and also for future engagements we can actually carry forward to also try and prevent, you know, making those same incredibly stupid mistakes again. So, you know, so that actually leads then to, you know, the question of ethical issues as a security company conducting spear phishing attacks. I had never thought about this. You know, if you are a security company and you are using other third parties as a pretext, is that okay? You know, because basically what you're doing is you're stealing the identity of a third party who did not sign a waiver with you. And you're causing them some kind of reputational damage, you know, even if you think it's not going to escape the environment of your customer. In this case, I did not think it was going to escape the Surf environment, but it did. You know, and that wound up causing some amount of damage. You know, thankfully, you know, in the end, it worked out. But the thing was, I did not ask setup in advance for their permission. Is that okay? I think actually, no, it's not okay. But, you know, it never occurred to me, because I just thought, oh, but everybody in the industry does this, right? I mean, this is normal, right? You know, and I just didn't even think about it twice until the situation blew up in my face. But then that leads to the question, well, if you're not going to be using third parties as pretexts, then what are you going to be using? You know, I mean, you can use things from the target organization. That's reasonably, you know, safe, because the target organization themselves have signed a waiver with you. You know, you can also make up pretexts, but that's expensive, you know, because if you're going to actually try and pretend, you know, to be a fake organization, that would mean you would actually need to create a plausible website for them and, you know, and all the context surrounding it. And of course, you know, who has the time and the budget for that? So it's actually kind of difficult, you know. So then, you know, the question really is, you know, is there some way to solve this problem? I mean, I can't really think of actually an easy way to solve it. I mean, is it perhaps possible that you could get a group of organizations together that give each other permission, you know, to use each other as phishing pretexts, you know, on the presumption that, you know, everybody needs to do phishing exercises occasionally, and it could very well be that, you know, you want to use some low-hanging fruit, you know, third parties to as pretexts to get people to click on them. You know, and perhaps, you know, on a friendly basis, could organizations maybe agree to allow others to use their identity for each other's phishing, you know, mails? I mean, I don't know if anybody actually is going to care enough to want to start such an initiative like this, but I mean, it could be one possible solution. But as you guys can see, it's actually really quite a tricky problem, you know? And I think that it's something that at least I'd never heard anybody thinking about it before. And I'm hoping that, you know, perhaps after this talk, maybe I've stimulated, you know, this discussion now, then you guys can think about it. And if you guys have any answers for how to solve this ethical problem, I'm all ears, you know, I want to hear it. So, but then back, I guess, to technical lessons learned. So, if you want to stop our phishing spam, there's a number of ways to do it. So, first of all, check SPF and DKIM values on your inbound mail. Another thing that you can do to try and, stop this kind of phishing attacks, or at least try and hinder it, is to disable default image loading in email clients. You know, for the similar reasons why you're trying to stop, you know, for privacy reasons, you know, all the click analytics things that are going on, it could very well be that malicious attackers are also using the same tools to try and see if you're opening stuff or not. So, you know, disabling image loading by default, but also disabling HTML in general is not necessarily a bad idea. Flag newly registered domains as suspicious. You know, clickanalytics.amsterdam, I mean, we only registered it, you know, a week before the job started, right? You know, or maybe a week into the job. So when you see domains that are extremely new, I mean, and of course you have this more often anyway when you're dealing with things like, you know, fast fluxing of domains. I mean, so I think in general, just for you know, domain name generation anyway in terms of malware and IOCs is kind of relevant. But also for spam, if you see anything newly registered, that's a reason perhaps to red flag it. Security awareness training. I mean, of course, you know, at the end, if you're doing these kinds of things, it's good to give a presentation to actually inform your staff of what you just did and what lessons they can learn from it. You know, in this particular case, I wanted to give also this talk to a wider audience because I think that there were a lot of interesting lessons from this that hopefully everyone can benefit from, even though some of the lessons were a little bit surprising. But of course, at the end, awareness training only gets you so far. You know, I mean, one thing that I really like to say and to tell people is that actually, you know, a really well-crafted phishing attack, you know, I would click on it. I mean, if it were really well-crafted. And the point is that you need to understand that awareness isn't enough. You need technical backups. You know, you need defense in depth. Because ultimately, if somebody really wants to phish you, they're going to. You know, it's just a matter of putting enough effort into constructing a believable pretext. So, you know, again, you want to pick up the low-hanging fruit, but you also want to understand that you need defense in depth because it's not going to be foolproof. And also, monitor network traffic. And that's actually kind of interesting, perhaps, for incident response later. Both with the Mozilla fake security update email, but also with what we did with setup. Of course, they actually went into their server logs and, you know, we're actually able to do some amount of sort of forensic analysis on it sort of after the fact. You know, at least SurfNet was able to. So, you know, to try and figure out where this came from. You know, if you're not doing the logging and you're not doing the monitoring, then of course you're not going to be able to tell where this stuff came from. So, again, that's, again, just best practices that hopefully you guys can do. So, yeah. So anyway, I found myself this job to be extremely interesting. I hope that you guys also found this presentation to be interesting. Maybe you learned something. And if anybody has any comments or questions, I would be happy to take them right now.
So, once again, Melanie.
Could you come closer to the mic?
Well, is it on?
Well, okay, thank you.
Is it on now?
The first question, ethical issue. I also perform such tests and it's not covered. Give you the the names of the employees who clicked on your phishing or spear phishing mails to your client or not. Because if the client gives the names of the employees they clicked, that can massive influence on this specific employees have.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess your question really is, should we be tracking the names of these people just in case naming and shaming is going to happen?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of naming and shaming. I think that with these kinds of experiments, it could be a good thing maybe to approach the people individually, privately. You know, I mean, because I think some amount of personal feedback, you know, is maybe okay. It could very well be also that an alternative is after the landing page, instead of just having insert malware here, you could actually have another page that explains, by the way, this was just a phishing test, you know, and you just clicked. That could be maybe another way of handling the situation, you know, in a way that they get immediate feedback that, oh crap, I just clicked, you know, without actually having to name and shame people. So I agree with you. I mean, I think that calling people out in front of their colleagues is generally not a good idea, but I also think that you don't have to. I mean, if I give a presentation like this, I like to give aggregate statistics. If people clicked, they know who they are. But I usually don't think it's a good idea to try and embarrass anybody.
Yeah, sure. But it's more ethical than, for me, can I use a LinkedIn content or Facebook, whatever?
Well, I mean, I think they're separate ethical issues. But yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Next.
Yeah.
So basically, a suggestion and a question. So at first, the suggestion. So when it comes to the can we use other organizations? Well, I've been doing a phishing exercise as well, where we not so much used another organization, but used the principle of word blindness. So in case of your email errors, radical.sexy, mm-hmm. just switch the D and the I, made it radical.sexy. Mm-hmm. And that gives you, in a domain name, just a large number of possibilities, which you can just use the typo squatting principle for phishing people, and they
sure.
will fall for that.
Yeah.
Without, of course, having to abuse other organizations. Mm-hmm. And then for the question, so, I mean, of course, you are tracking all the people that clicked and the images that have been gone. Have you also considered like the privacy implications of storing that information and how long you can store it for?
Well, I consider that kind of information to be similar to generic pen testing information. I mean, obviously, both, from the spirit of the law as well as the spirit of just trying to do things right. I mean, it's best not to retain, you know, personal data and customer data any longer than we have to. You know, periodically at Radically Open Security, we go, you know, archiving and purging pen test repositories for our various customers. How long we keep it around sort of usually tends to be how long we think we need it for. In the case of the spear phishing suite, I mean, we've basically taken the suite itself and kind of made it generic. Oh, I forgot to mention, by the way, we open sourced this. So the actual toolkit itself is available on our GitHub. So if you go to radicallyopensecurity.com, if you go to github.com/radicallyopensecurity, the spear phishing toolkit is actually on there. People, of course, have also asked, do you feel it's ethical open sourcing this toolkit? But, I assume the real attackers, the evil guys, have their own toolkits as well. So, but, So the generic stuff, I try and separate out and keep the actual customer data. I try to purge every so often, if I think that they're going to want repeated, retests or that kind of stuff, then I might keep it around a little bit longer. But to me, that's more a generic data retention issue, not a phishing issue. Thank you.
Hi, Melanie. Once again, a nice talk. Just a small technical question. You mentioned that you found 26 individual IP addresses from which there was clicked.
Is that yes.
Where are these from? I mean, I'm presuming they're not all from the organization itself, but from remote users, or what was that?
Yeah, I think it probably was a mix. I mean, some of it I think were on their work machines or laptops. I mean, some of it was from their mobile devices. I mean, we saw a mix of clients. Obviously, you can track that somewhat from the web logs from the landing page. So,
And doesn't that doesn't have implications for, say, the target's ability to do forensics on whatever they're sort of clicking on? Because it sounds like they would miss a lot of the activity of their staff.
How would they miss activity?
Well, I mean, if they're clicking from IP addresses that they're not controlled by the organization, I mean, they don't control those 26 IP addresses, not all of them.
Yeah. Look, I think that basically, again, they were using multiple devices, and we can actually verify that anyway, because the hash that we were using basically translates back to the email address that we sent to the target. So if we can see that multiple IP addresses are actually coming from a single email address, and we can see that one of them is maybe a MacBook Pro and the other one is an Android phone, you know, I mean, that also, of course, gives us information about the platforms that the targets are using. I mean, does it make our phishing any less effective? I don't think so.
I think that's very interesting additional information, but not the point I was looking at, and that is the opportunities that the target organization has to defend itself against these phishing attacks, because obviously they don't track all the click activity of their staff.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, anytime you have multiple devices, it makes monitoring
it's
and
hard
controlling
work,
things harder. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for clarification.
Thank you.
Next question.
Hi, thanks for the talk. What I've seen as sort of most effective at getting people where I work to click on emails has always been fake purchase orders, fake invoices. Yeah. And with that, you can actually target it to look like the type of customers they would typically have. Mm-hmm. Is that something you experimented with?
With vendors. In this particular case with SurfNet, no. With other customers I've had, yes. So, yeah. Again, it sort of depends on how we're doing the targeting. I mean, I think with this particular one, we were being a little bit wild in our use of third parties, but I've also had, but again, the target was 150 employees. We've also done spear phishing where it actually really was spear phishing, and I was just targeting, like, for example, a support desk of an organization with real client-side malware, you know, to actually, you know, be the first step of the kill chain. You know, in those cases, then we're going to approach it really differently. And then we're going to try and usually use something that's a little bit closer to the organization. Yeah.
If a regular spam filter is already kind of a pain for people doing spear phishing, should we be training Bayesian filters specifically to spot spear phishing as distinct from other kinds of spam and basically giving organizations a set of metrics, like how many spear phishing emails are you getting right now? Where are they coming from? How many people are opening them? And just, you know, get that view into the IT department.
Yeah, that is a super question. I never thought of it. I think to me that sounds like interesting research. Thank you. So no more questions? Okay. Well, thank you guys so much for your time.
So I've got a question. I'm just curious, how many of you are professionals in this field that do spear phishing? Can I see a small raise of hands? Well, that you do spear, you're involved in spear phishing activity to pen test, for example. Okay, so and what percentage of you use other organizations as a cover to do that? So if you raise your hands first and then put them down if you don't. So could you raise your hand if you do spear phishing? Right? So that's and then raise them down if you don't do that. So sorry, yeah, that's unclear. If you don't do don't use other organizations, then you can put your hand down again. So I just want to see the hands up in the air of the people who do that use other organizations. So that's only one
person.
I think
his question is how many of you here use third parties as pretexts during your phishing
test? Too much beer last
night. Raise
your
hand if you use third parties.
Okay, so thank you for saying that. And I'm curious to hear you guys talk about this because, of course, as organization being used as a pretext, we were a little bit surprised. I'm a little bit surprised as well to hear that this is such a common practice. So I'm curious to hear other voices on the ethical question of that, because we did not like this at all.
So our red team engagements, engagements are very much backed by governance and compliance that comes from central
government. Sorry, I cannot understand what you're saying. Sorry.
I said, our red team engagements are very much backed by compliance that comes from central government. So we roll all the way up the tree to, yeah, for example, the Bank of England, CSG, etc. So there's a degree of responsibility that flows all the way down. We've not had any instances where it's caused a specific problem, but on the other hand, we also maintain quite a large stock of credible domains, credible assets that sit outside either a real organization or outside the target organization.
Okay, and so with your case, you say there's some kind of chain of command where you can, the organizations you use as cover are somehow related to the organization you're testing, so then there's some kind of responsibility or?
They certainly can be. It largely depends, but yeah, there are instances and opportunities to leverage that. Yeah, if we're working for a bank, the chances are that they roll up to the Bank of England, for example. There are conversations that can be had because we are trying to simulate as close to real world as possible.
And it's never blown up in your face?
Yeah. Indeed, that does lead to opportunistic domain squatting by security companies. And I've seen this also happen multiple times. So
it's never blown up in our face. The most amusing incident was when we pretended to be an upstream ISP of our target. And essentially reported ourselves for phishing, just to see how that would work. And we ended up getting responses back that indicated that they thought we were the upstream ISP. So, but okay. No, never seen it blown up.
And you?
I have a question. If you, for the breach investigation, did you get the headers of the email?
For us?
Yeah. Like before you started looking, if you were spamming actually the Surfnet, have you looked at, like, did you request them to send you the email that they were spammed with? Because then you would probably seen that it was not you spamming, right?
That's a good question. I don't know. My colleague might have. So I was more busy with trying to fix the web server, and he was more busy on that side of communicating with Surfnet. So that's, I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
Yeah, as I understand things, I mean, they got the setup got the technical details from Surf. And yes, Surf looked at the mail server headers. And we, again, as I said before, we made absolutely zero attempt at hiding our tracks. So it was obvious that we were using the Radically Open Security mail server. We made absolutely no attempts to cover this up. So yes, they noticed this extremely quickly.
Thank you. But yeah, all right. Thank you.